That's Hank Mobley on tenor sax opening up on A Slice of the Top, the title track of his 1966 album. James Spaulding on alto sax, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Kyan Zawadi on euphonium, Howard Johnson on tuba, McCoy Tyner on piano, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. What a collection. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we start off with some not-so-pleasant news. As you know, or you may know, the Baltimore case of Freddie Gray has concluded with a third police officer connected with his death acquitted of all charges today by the judge. Cesar Goodson, the third officer and supposed star defendant, tried in connection with the brutal murder of Freddie Gray, today was cleared of all charges, including second-degree depraved heart murder, three counts of manslaughter, assault, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office. This is no surprise to those of you who are regular listeners of Lead Stories. Why? Because we have had the benefit of the expertise and experience of Alton Maddox Jr., who is one of the best defense lawyers I know on the planet, who has deconstructed this case for us all along the way, as he has done with others, and he's here to decipher the verdict that just came in. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Eutrice.
Well, I know that we will be pursuing this in greater detail next week, but let's talk about what you predicted. You predicted this was going to be the outcome. Could you tell us and remind us of the basis on which you made that claim?
Well, I think the most important thing to recognize in every case is that the facts are always different in every case. And the first thing that you have to do is to recognize the plan that the opposition, or in this case, the state attorney's office, is using, and then to create a plan in opposition to that plan, and after that, hopefully, it's your own target and what you predicted to happen. And so, you know, when I looked at this case and looked at the facts and recognized that that she was up against the wall, in the sense that initially there was a tremendous amount of pressure that was being placed on her by the Baltimore community. And I think the key word is pressure, because we must sustain that pressure at all times to get a result that we can live with. And many times, at some point, we sort of back off from the pressure. And at that point, that gives the other side an opportunity to do what they want to do. And this is what essentially happened here. Initially, the first thing I recognized was she was using a preemptive strike as a way of cooling off the community and giving her some temporary confidence.
What was that preemptive strike?
Well, the preemptive strike was the way that she made her announcement that the police officers will certainly be prosecuted or indicted. And while, you know, she certainly sustained that, but once she realized that there was a cooling off period, then she let up off of the pedal. And that's where things went awry. And I think at that point, what we have to recognize is that when you look at the caption of any case, especially when you are black, you must recognize that it is a class action. It always talk about the people against a particular person. But the reality of it is that you cannot afford to rely on the people to drive home your particular interest in a case, And I believe that in cases like this, you have to intervene. And I believe that because it is a class action, meaning the people or the state of Maryland or United States of America, whoever the case might be, that you have to recognize that it is really against the class and not against the particular person, one way or the other. And so, you know, what became pretty striking here was is the fact that once there was no class intervention in this case, you know, that gave the police department an opportunity to opt for a bench trial, which I think is, can be extremely dangerous in these cases. You know, we saw that in the case of Sean Bell here in New York, who had been shot at 50 times and ended up with the black community holding the bag because there was no conviction of the injuries that Sean Bell had sustained. And so the lesson to be learned there is that you have to be forever vigilant, and that if you intervene in a class action, one of the issues that are going to come up is a question of whether the police officer has a right to a jury trial or to a bench trial. And I think the response from the class would have to be that while a defendant is entitled to a jury trial, but no defendant is entitled to a bench trial. And
but
so
we did not see whether this is attributable to a lack of experience, mindful of the fact that Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, is new to this position and fairly young professionally in this position. There were a number of tactical errors that you had pointed out that allowed you to predict the outcome not only of this case, the case of Goodson, but also the case against the two other officers who were acquitted, and that's the case of Officer Edward Nero, and we had the case of William Porter, also affiliated with this trial, that ended in a hung jury last year. Now we have the third. She's batting 3-0, where we had the third of six officers who are connected and had been charged in the Freddie Gray case. Half of the case is over, and this particular Officer Goodson, was supposed to have been the star defendant. But we saw along the way all these tactical errors, tactical legal errors being committed, and one of them was just what you just mentioned. We did not see an objection by Ms. Mosby to the demand and the permission granted for this officer to have a bench trial, although it is not a constitutional right. So could you outline some of the other tactical problems that you saw both with both previous defendants and that continued with the prosecution of this case against Goodson?
And I will. And the thing that I raised there was there should have been what, in my mind, and what the law called a Nuremberg prosecution. And that is where you start out with the superior officer in the case, and then you wiggle your way down to those who are on the lower rungs of the ladder. And so when you fail to make Rice, who was a superior officer in this case, in the Freddie Gray case, at least that is, when you fail to make him the lead defendant, you begin to undermine your chances of ever getting him. And in this particular case, now as the case is currently postured, Rice stands a good possibility of not ever being charged or prosecuted at all. And so, you know, we didn't know it, initially that the other two or three defendants were going to suffer the fate that they have suffered or enjoyed the benefits that they've enjoyed. But since they have, you also have, now even if you stick with our prediction, you have all of these defendants either acquitted or not convicted. and you have Rice, who has never been touched. And so what I was saying back then was, is that the great tip-off to that is how you line up the parties, in this case, the defendants in a case. And when I saw that Rice was not going to be the lead defendant, you know, then I realized that that's not who they were really going after. Although in my mind, I don't know how you can have a superior officer on the scene and directing all the traffic and not, on the other hand, allow him to go scot-free. And, you know, I bring that up because, you know, obviously I've had a lot of other cases with that kind of experience. But I've also had, you know, the case of Pagonis versus Maddox, Mason, Shopton, and Brawley, in which I was the lead defendant. And so the theory of New York was that I was the architect of the case in terms of Tawana, and that if anybody needs to be convicted, I should be. And fortunately for me, I'm the only one who lives still on field. And I can still continue to call Pagonis who he is, and that is the man that raped Tawana Brawley. And that certainly was not supposed to be the outcome. And as a result of that, New York has now retaliated by claiming that I have been disbarred and not simply suspended for 5 years.
Well, we got the point of the order of prosecution that gave you the hint, the first hint, that the focus was not where it ought to have been. In what has transpired so far in this case, does anything strike you as being worthy of investigation as either prosecutorial or judicial misconduct in this trial?
Well, I think even before we go there, I would like to say that at this stage of the proceedings, and I believe we need to simply wait and see what the next move is on the part of the prosecution. But at this stage of the proceedings, it is my view that the prosecution is going to be accused of collateral estoppel, and therefore some judge in an appellate court is going to intervene and say there can be no further prosecutions.
Take a little minute for those of us who are not as well initiated in court terms as you can. Explain that term that you just used, collateral estoppel.
Well, collateral estoppel is a derivative of double jeopardy in the criminal sense of the term. In the sense that where you have the same prosecution with the same parties, you know, the Constitution forbids a re-prosecution after the person may have been acquitted. Here, when you talk about collateral estoppel, you're not necessarily talking about the same parties, but you're talking about similar issues. And the question becomes whether, in this case, the state's attorney's office has had an opportunity to litigate sufficiently in prior cases to simply demonstrate now that there's no reason for any subsequent litigation, because any subsequent litigation now would have to deviate from the way that the judges have tried this earlier cases, and therefore it would be unfair and unjust. And so I'm simply saying that at this point, the Maryland appellate courts, if there was another prosecution, may look at this and say, wait a minute, you know, you've had an opportunity to go after two or three others. You had an opportunity to litigate some of the issues that now will be common to the remaining defendants. And the judge has already acquitted those prior parties, and there would be no reason for us to continue to allow you to go after somebody else, which may produce an unjust or inequitable result.
I asked a question earlier about why we did not see any resistance from the prosecutor with regard to the demand for a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial. Certainly, the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, was aware of the fact that in recent history, there's never been an instance in which a police officer committing or alleged to be committing or to have committed a crime while on duty was ever convicted in a bench trial. And so I wonder what kind of research went into this decision not to object strenuously to a bench trial. And the reason I asked about the prosecutorial or possible prosecutorial misconduct is even if she did not ask, the judge simply did not seem to raise this as a question as it pertains to him and the integrity of the trial that he was going to preside over. It seems to me that somebody would have said, this is an unusual request, and it ought to be dealt with before we proceed with this trial.
Well, you know, one thing that the people look at from a judicial point of view or from a law enforcement point of view is to look at three primary groups that are always involved in these kinds of cases. The first group, especially when it comes to a black victim, the first group is a political duopoly. And so now you don't no longer have the separation of powers doctrine, which is supposed to be in play in most cases, but you have two major political parties acting in concert with each other. Second group that has to be looked at is the special interest groups, and normally those interest groups are those who put up money to protect their interests, and that's why they're special. And so this particular group consists of the law enforcement personnel in Baltimore that has a particular interest in protecting all of its officers. And third group would be the pressure groups, and certainly to the extent that pressure existed in this case, particularly from the black community, the pressure was obviously unorganized and was not sustained. And so the bet then is that we should do as we hope to do, and that is to exonerate all of these cops of any guilt in the death of Freddie Gray.
We have three other officers awaiting trial, and that means half of the trial, as I said earlier, is over. What do you think is about to happen with the other half of the trial against Lieutenant Brian Rice, Sergeant Alicia White, and Officer Garrett Miller?
Well, what I think is what I really just outlined, and of course in New York it would be called an Article 78, but I'm not familiar with the particular term in Maryland, but it would be something similar to what we call an Article 78. In which you actually intervene in a proceeding under Article 78 of the criminal procedure law in New York. And so I would believe that at this stage, Officer Rice and the others would simply go into the Maryland court, appellate courts, and argue that enough is enough, and that we already know what the outcome has been, and now we know what the outcome in the future cases should be, and there's no reason for us to be wasting any more judicial time on this case.
Does this mean, in a way, that Prosecutor Marilyn Mosby has no real refuge here to explain what appears to be a less than thorough preparation for this case and less than experienced anticipation of the legal tactics that were likely to be taken? Does it mean that some other entity should could step in or could be made to step in to continue this trial, or will this trial run its course, however it turns out, and then some other entity, perhaps like the Justice Department, will be asked to review this case, but it would already have been prosecuted?
Well, and those are two great questions that are being asked. And the answer is that, first of all, it is my contention that no elected official, no elected prosecutor can ever get a fair result for the people because there's an inherent conflict of interest in an elected prosecutor trying to prosecute wayward police officers. And so that problem existed with Trayvon Martin and with just so many other cases that it's a hard hurdle to get around, and it becomes a legislative question because the legislature has to look at how do you actually streamline a prosecutorial case to prevent any biases and conflicts of interest and other barriers to the people of a particular state acquiring justice. And I think that's something that has to be examined by Maryland now because it does not provide a basis right now for anybody to believe that people in Baltimore could get a just result. And secondly, as it relates to the Justice Department, you know, I think that there's also some serious questions that have to be raised there, because in my mind, there's too much discretion, prosecutorial discretion, in the hands of the Justice Department as to what case they intervene in. And so there needs to be a tightening of the way that these cases are decided. I mean, the way it is now, we don't know what cases go in and what cases don't. I mean, we had, you know, a case right here with against Limerick Nelson that ended up with him being acquitted and then afterwards him being prosecuted on federal civil rights charges, and, you know, and then they got a conviction. But and this was not a case in which one would have suspected that there would be an invocation of civil rights violations, but nonetheless it was. So I think that clearly there are going to have to be some legislative changes, not only in terms of the state, but also in terms of the federal government, as to how do you streamline these prosecutions in such a way that both sides receive fair treatment.
Well, I raised a question in the context of the role of the Justice Department in other cases of major, it seems, major and flagrant violations of civil rights that resulted in the deaths of civilians. And the question really is, here you have a situation in which a man being transported from point A to point B in a police van ends up with a spinal cord, a snapped spine, a broken neck, and the possible result of gross negligence and mistreatment by a group of police officers. Should the Justice Department have intervened immediately in this investigation, since police organized and perhaps conspiratorial police conduct we see here, and should have determined to what degree the police officers actually engaged in a criminal act before the trial actually proceeded? I'm trying to get a sense of the sequence here and the range of authority, whether the Justice Department had a more immediate concern here, because this particular death inflamed the entire community, engulfed the city in flames, and was a blatant example of the extreme treatment that many people of color have been getting at the hands of police. So which a chicken and egg kind of legal question. Should the Justice Department's intervention have preceded the prosecution of these police officers?
Well, I think that the law in that area is sort of loosely stated, but one can certainly argue, as you're stating here, that the Justice Department should take a more keener interest in the Freddie Gray case, especially since you consider the fact that Freddie Gray is a member of a protected class. And so when a member of a protected class is injured by law enforcement personnel, red flags should certainly be hanging all over the Justice Department building as to this particular case. And that's the reason why I say that now, you know, Congress is going to have to really revisit this entire area of just how do you protect a protected class of people, especially descendants of enslaved Africans and others and persons of African ancestry, in terms of exercising their rights, because you have now a whole body of history as well as law to suggest that Congress has to be a lot more vigilant in these areas. And as we point out, I mean, we don't really know the way that Congress acts and the way that the Justice Department acts as to what the prediction is going to be. I mean, we can sit here now and say that we should be intervening now, but there's no guarantee, because the way that they seem to have trashed the civil rights laws, it opens it up for virtually any type of case to go under the radar screen.
Well, also because already we've seen blatant examples of how in these kinds of cases, the defendants, meaning the police officers, automatically benefit from privileges that the average defendant couldn't possibly, an average defendant couldn't get a bench trial because he wants one. An average defendant can't get a case moved out of one jurisdiction to another because it suits him and because a judge would be more favorable in that situation. I'm referring, for example, to the case the case from the Bronx, where the police officers, where the case was moved from the Bronx because the
you mean Amadou Diallo?
Amadou Diallo. Why am I
right? Talking? Okay.
The officers determined they were not going to get a fair trial because the jury was likely to be made up of predominantly Latinos and African Americans, so they were permitted to move it to Albany, where they were to get a more sympathetic hearing from a judge and a bench trial. So these things started out at the very beginning of these cases, and in which uniformed defendants seem to get an entirely different treatment within the court system. And it seems to me that there ought to be some kind of preventive measure, somebody monitoring these kinds of cases, because they also have such ripple effects as, for example, in Baltimore, where the entire community is so outraged, they just broke out. And then, you know, it just becomes a safety issue and so forth. These are very, very volatile cases. So the absence of the Justice Department or any overarching monitoring agency says, again, it reinforces the point that the state should be left alone to deal with these things. And we know, as we're seeing in this case, that undue pressures can change the outcome of these cases, or certainly can affect it.
Well, you know, the one thing that you know that is missing here, and the one that you obviously are very much aware of, because you know, you somewhat gave me the distinction of being the people's attorney general, is the fact that what the state does not need is for some, quote, interloper, close quote, in the judicial system. And so, you know, the idea that you will not allow things to be behaving as they should be behaving traditionally means that you are a problem. And that's the point that we're making here, because even when you go back to the Amadou Diallo case, you're absolutely right that not only was the citizens of Bronx County denied of a right to participate in a jury trial, but you also had a black judge who, by simply moving the case to the third department, deprived her of the right to sit in judgment of the case. And so the fact that nobody filed any intervention motion for class action to really contest these matters, you know, actually brought about the result that happened. And the fact that, you know, you may have a lawyer who decides that, well, I want to put something else into the mix, you know, is something that is unheard of in terms of the way that these proceedings should really operate. So you have the right, there should be a watchdog to make sure that the prosecutors don't come lapdogs in this process and give the police department an added advantage. And secondly, the thing that I think we have to consider is that everybody talk about the Second Amendment, and today, you know, we have black lawmakers who are revolting in the nation's capital. But nobody talk about those other aspects of the Second Amendment in terms of why there is a Second Amendment. And the fear was that of a standing army. And so now you have a standing army in Baltimore, you have a standing army in Chicago and New York and other places. But in addition to just simply being a standing army, they have the right to engage in collective bargaining. And so the right to engage in collective bargaining means that they can put undue pressure on the legislature to even, in my case, have me removed from the practice of law under what I call a bill of pains and punishment. Because of their right to engage in collective bargaining, which does not seem to be a matter of a real concern and issues in the state, and one in which the people must begin to say, hey, they do not have a right to engage in that kind of bargaining because it is a standing army. And, you know, we have to find ways of putting this standing army in check.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to give us this brief overview in the wake of the recently declared victory for Cesar Goodson, the third officer and star defendant in the Freddie Gray case, to walk free of all charges, including second-degree depraved heart murder, three counts of manslaughter, assault, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office. Thanks so much, Alton, and we will proceed next week with a more detailed understanding about the tactics that need to be adopted in these kinds of cases that the people have the power to do. Thanks so much, though, for being with us today.
And, Eutrice, if you may, let me quickly announce that June 28th, which is next Tuesday in the Brooklyn Supreme Court, all of us should be very much concerned also about the illegal prosecution of children as adults, especially parents of those children. And this will be my first time reentering the practice of law in New York, and I hope that the rest of my career will be devoted to the benefit of our people, and particularly in terms of their representation for justice.
Look forward to it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll take this break and come back and talk about what exactly is terrorism? Who defines it? What is it? Right after this. We'll be right back. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, in the immediate aftermath of the June 12th massacre of 49 people and the wounding of 53 others at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, President Barack Obama told the nation that the alleged lone gunman, Omar Mateen, a 29-year-old security guard, had committed, quote, an act of terror, unquote, and, quote, an act of hate, unquote. Various other officials in his administration, including Homeland Security Secretary Jeh Johnson, FBI Director James Comey, and their boss, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, have echoed the president's characterization of the tragedy, and it appears to be the legal definition that is informing the government's ongoing investigations. But the definition of terrorism, which is, to my mind, legally expansive and very fuzzy, leaves much to be argued about. When is a crime terrorism? When is it an act of hate? When is it something else? Who gets to decide this? So I thought we would begin to discuss this question about terrorism and how we are to react about this term. It's a done deal. The FBI's definition of terrorism, and you can go to FBI.gov and look at it. There are many codes developed, legal codes, by which something is described as terrorism. But since these things happened on U.S. soil, we can look at what the FBI defines as domestic terrorism. According to the FBI, there are three characteristics to domestic terrorism. It will involve acts dangerous to human life that violate federal or state law. It would appear intended, one, to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, two, to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or three, to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping, and occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the U.S. Okay. Then it has something, section 18 U.S.C., section 233, 2332B, defining the term federal crime of terrorism as an offense that is calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government by intimidation or coercion, or to retaliate against government conduct, and is in violation of one of several listed statutes, including relating or killing or attempted killing during an attack on a federal facility with a dangerous weapon, and relating to killing or attempted killing of officers and employees of the United States. Well, that is, we see how this definition of terrorism has been amended in reaction to many developments, many instances in which crimes have been committed that need to be addressed legislatively and by law in order to allow for prosecution of the people committing such crimes. But you can also appreciate how expansive the definition is of terrorism. You can, with these definitions that I've just read and shared with you, they're so vague, they're so general, that they could be made to apply to anything, as we have seen. And some crimes could be described as terrorism, while other crimes could be described as hate crimes, and still other crimes could be described just as standard issue crimes that could be prosecuted under state or local statutes, even though they have elements of terrorism as defined by the federal government, by law. So we have to ask ourselves this question about what constitutes terrorism, because we see a very strange kind of a non-uniform application of its provisions. Now, the massacre in Orlando, automatically the president from the word go said this was an act of terrorism and an act of hate. And his administration and all of his agency heads are saying exactly the same thing. I had been comparing and contrasting, as you recall, the murders just last year, the mass murders in South Carolina by Dylann Roof, of 9 people at Mother Emanuel AME Church a little more than a year ago. Here was a person whose act of terror included assassination. We just read the definition right there. The FBI says it includes assassination. We had the public official who was a pastor of the church, Reverend Pinckney, assassinated along with members of his congregation. He was an elected official. A political act was committed there by Dylann Roof, but it was not considered an act of terrorism. It was considered an unfortunate thing. The president said they died nobly. And what was required wasn't swift action and prosecution, although that did happen, and he will be going to trial on it, but not as a terrorist, not as an assassin, but as a mass murderer. But the defense is already clear. He was a little bit out of his mind. We have a very strange definition that seems to apply under certain circumstances. And this is what I want to ask you. What do you understand it to be? Are you clear as to what, from the government's point of view, constitutes terrorism and what does not? I just read you the definition. This is the FBI's definition. Again, I'm not making it up. Go to FBI.gov and you read what comprises a terrorist act. And when you read that, you say to yourself, well, how is it that so many mass killings did not qualify as terrorism? We just finished discussing a case in Baltimore where there appears to be an organized effort to subvert justice. And the reason for the case, it seems to me, suggests that the officers engaged in an act of terror that resulted in the brutal death of this man, Freddie Gray. They conspired. That is not considered an act of terrorism. Why? Perhaps because they were uniformed officers, and uniformed officers are incapable of committing acts of terror. Only civilians, perhaps. Although we did have that exception, we had an exception of a psychiatrist who had shot many people at a military installation, and that was considered an act of terror. It was interesting because he was of Arab extraction. This is the case of Major Nidal Malik Hassan, a psychiatrist. You remember in 2009 opened fire with 2 handguns at Fort Hood in Texas. That was considered an act of terror. Well, how is it that we have these definitions kind of, there's a fuzziness about when and how and to whom they apply? So what are your thoughts? We will continue this discussion, but it's good to start it today. I particularly refer to something that came to my attention and to the nation's attention, and that is after 52 years, half a century, the federal government closed the case on the murders of the three civil rights workers who went to the South to organize voters. And that's James Chaney, he was 21 at the time, Andrew Goodman, 20 at the time, and Michael Schwerner, 24 at the time, who disappeared when they were on their mission to register voters in the South. Their killers and the support system, which was the local Klan, which is today, I mean, what else could you consider it at the time, committing all these acts of violence and murder in the South? It was a domestic terrorist organization following an articulated ideology based on racial supremacy of whites over everybody else and their right, as it were, to summarily take anybody's life. And they did. Now, even in closing the case, the government refuses to attribute this group murder, the three young men, to terrorism. They will not acknowledge that the KKK committed a terrorist act. They would not admit that the burning of Rosewood, Florida, literally just making the entire town disappear, these were acts of terrorism. So we see terrorism and the concept of terrorism emerging within the context of recent historical developments having to do with geopolitics and race at the same time. You could be born in the United States, as Omar Mateen was, but still a terrorist. If you are of Arab extraction, or in his case, once you're Muslim, if you're Muslim, he was of Afghanistan, Afghan parentage. So you could be a Muslim. You qualify for you could be a Muslim and qualify for terrorist status. But you also could be a U.S. citizen like Dylann Roof and simply be, well, a murderer. So how does this work? What are your impressions? 888-874-4888. We have time for at least a couple of calls. Ma'at, you're on the air. Are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Good afternoon, family.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
I would say, it's a good question, Yatrice. I would say there's a definite agenda. So, I have a book and I misplaced it, so that's always a problem with my jumble. But it's by Trevor Aronson, and it's called The Terror Factory. And he won't acknowledge and he won't deal with what is to me the evident false flag of September 11th, 01, but he gives case after case after case where the FBI actually brings in a very coercive informant and literally creates a plot that homeless people or developmentally challenge people wouldn't have a clue and don't have a plugged nickel, And so I think we need to look at that. And
but what is your understanding? What is your reference point about this word terrorism or terrorist? What do you think when you hear it?
What I think is a created agenda, a war on terrorism, that when Operation Paperclip Germans were brought over here, Werner von Braun actually said that there would be a period coming in the U.S. where there would be a war on terrorism. So I say that it's a creative agenda. We need to look at it very closely. It's a creative agenda for perpetual war. And to bring in an interesting perspective, I don't know, Utrice, if you're familiar with Michelle Chosadovsky, Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter had him recently on. He breaks it down. He breaks it down, the whole war on terror, what it's all about, who ISIS is supported and created by. So that might be something. And he has a couple books on it.
All right.
Well,
thank you.
Books. Yes.
Thanks for getting the conversation started. What I'm asking is, what does the word do to you when we hear about terrorism and terrorist and terror? Coming from official sources and semi-official sources, but nonetheless authoritative sources, it may be the media, it may be governmental officials, as high up as the president. You say a crime of hate and this is an act of terrorism. Are you conflicted about the definition of terrorism and who is a terrorist and what are the prevailing conditions and what are the exact provisions in the law that allow people to be characterized as terrorists and others to be characterized as something else? And the ways in which they are treated by the law, their rights under law that they have when they are categorized as such. When a person is categorized as a terrorist, what does it mean? How do you react to this word? That's the discussion today. How do you react to this word? We'll get into the details also next week. But we ought to start with what the word does to you. Vincent, you're on the air.
Well, my remark might be a little too broad, but if you go back to one of the biggest situations in New York when the World Trade Center was hit, initially they didn't show any face of those suspected individuals, but I had a feeling that when they would, there would be a people of color. And ever since then, most broadly, the term is being used to be attributed to people of color, and the words and ideology so referred to are to be demonized, even though a word might be a peace. But more and more when you see people being accused of something or hear of them being accused of something and you don't see their face until after the demonization publicity goes about, then when they show a face, it will have to be a person of color. Doesn't mean that they did it. Doesn't mean that they're guilty. But people would not pay attention to the due process aspect of the accusation.
Do you think that, do you feel that there has been a definitive process here of very closely defining this? Or do you think that the definition of terror, terrorism, terrorist, these definitions are very broad?
I might say extremely broad.
And in what way does this, again, relate to the point you're making? If it's extremely broad, what does that mean when these people, whoever they turn out to be, are presented to you and me and the rest of the world as terrorists, engaging in terrorism?
Well, some people don't really focus on the investigative part of what the accusation is. and the person who is being accused, because they don't really initially make that clear when an incident is supposedly to have happened, but to put out everything with dramatization and negativity. So within your mind, it cannot be other than a person of color. It cannot be a person who might be white included in that. And it has to be more commonly associated with a person of African descent, maybe, or of color. And once you accept that thought, then it increases your fear factor of thinking of people of color of being nonviolent.
Well, thank you so much for adding to the discussion today and getting us started. Thank you. Tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday, so get your brains in gear to discuss the issues that matter most to you. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, plural, at gmail.com. It is a great pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll continue the discussion tomorrow. Bye-bye.